"The sage," the other man says. "Hey, chief," the captain replies. "Suicide or homicide?" "I don't know yet. Sexual assault seems like a given, though." Rich, the guy's covered in blood from head to toe, and he's lying here in his tidy whiteies. "You think he got sexually assaulted and then committed harikari?" the police chief snorts. "I know I don't have the vast detective experience you do after 15 years on the job in the metropolis of Townsend, but..." I look down at the list in my notebook. What would Dr. Henry Lee do? Well, he'd examine the wounds up close. He'd analyze why there was only superficial blood, that pink transfer on the snow, without any dripping or spatter. He'd note the footprints in the snow, one set that matches the lone sneaker on the victim's foot, and the other set that has been matched to the jogger who found the body. He'd ask why, after a sexual assault, the victim would still be wearing his underwear if other items of clothing were still removed. I am so cold, I'm shaking. I stomp my frozen feet in their sneakers. Then I look down at the ground, and suddenly everything's crystal clear. "Actually," I say, stepping out of my hiding place, "you're both wrong."
This ends Disc 1. House Rules, Disc 2.
Rich. I don't know why I kid myself into thinking that I'll get anything done on the weekends. I have the best intentions, but something always gets in the way. Today, for example, I was determined to build an ice rink in the backyard for Sasha, my 7-year-old. She lives with my ex, Hannah, but she's with me from Friday night to Sunday, and she's currently planning on joining the U.S. figure skating team, if she doesn't become a singing veterinarian. I figured she'd get a kick out of helping me flood the tarp I set up in the back, bordered by 2x4s that I hammered into place all week long after work, just to get ready. I promised her that when she woke up on Sunday morning, she'd be able to skate. What I hadn't counted on was the fact that it would be so freaking cold outside. Sasha started to whine as soon as the wind picked up, so I nixed the plan and drove her to dinner in Burlington instead. She's a big fan of one place where you can draw on the tablecloths. She falls asleep on the car ride home while I'm still singing along to Hannah Montana songs on her CD. And I carry her upstairs to her bedroom. It's a haven of pink in a bachelor pad. During the settlement, I got the house, but Hannah got nearly everything inside it. It's weird to pick Sasha up from her other home and see her new stepdad sprawled on my old couch. She stirs a little while I get her undressed and into her nightgown, but then she sighs and curls on her side beneath the covers. For a minute, I just stare at her. Most of the time, being the only detective in a one-horse town is a losing battle. I get paid crap. I investigate cases that are too dull to even make the police log in the local paper. But I'm making sure that Sasha's world, or at least this tiny corner of it, is a little bit safer. It keeps me going. Well, that and my 20-year retirement bonus. Downstairs, I grab a flashlight and head out to the aborted ice rink. I turn on the hose. If I stay up for a few more hours, maybe there will be enough water in the tarp to freeze overnight. I don't like breaking promises. I leave that to my ex. I'm not a bitter guy. I'm not. It's just that in my profession, it's a lot easier to see actions as either right or wrong, without shades of explanation between them. I didn't really need to know how Hannah realized her soulmate was not the guy she'd married, but instead the one who serviced the coffee machines in the teacher's room. "He started bringing hazelnut for me," she said, and somehow I was supposed to be able to understand that meant I don't love you anymore. Back inside, I open the fridge and grab a bottle of Sam Adams. I settle down on the couch, turn on a Bruins game on NESN, and pick up the newspaper. Although most guys turn to the stocks or sports page, I always go for the entertainment section, because of the column in the back. I'm hooked on an agony aunt. That's the old-fashioned term for an advice column. She calls herself Auntie M, and she's my guilty pleasure. I've fallen in love with my best friend, and I know I'll never be with him. So how do I get over him? My partner just walked out and left me with a 4-month-old baby. Help. Can you be depressed if you're only 14? There are 2 things I like about this column. That the letters are a constant reminder my life doesn't suck as much as someone else's, and that there is at least one person on this planet who seems to have all the answers. Auntie M is forever coming up with the most practical solutions, as if the key to the great riddles of existence involves surgically cutting away the emotional component and looking at just the facts. She's probably 80 years old and living with a horde of cats, but I kind of think Auntie M would make a great cop. The last letter takes me by surprise. I'm married to a great guy, but I can't stop thinking about my ex and wondering if I made a mistake. Should I tell him? My eyes widen, and I can't keep myself from checking the byline. The letter writer doesn't live in Stratford, like Hannah, but instead hails from Stowe. Get a grip, Rich, I tell myself silently. I reach for the beer bottle, and I'm just about to take that first indescribable sip when my cell phone rings. Matson, I answer.
Captain, sorry to bug you on your night off.
It's Joey Urquhart, a rookie patrolman. I'm sure it's my imagination, but the new officers get younger every year. This one's probably still wearing a pull-up at night. No doubt he's calling to ask me where we keep the extra Kleenex down at the station, or something equally inane. The new kids know better than to bother the chief, and I'm the second in command.
It's just that we got a report of a dead body, and I figured you'd want to know.
Immediately, I'm on alert. I know better than to ask him questions, like if there are signs of foul play or if we're talking suicide. I'll figure that out myself. Where? He gives me the address of a state highway near a stretch of conservation land. It's a popular place for cross-country skiers and snowshoers this time of year. I'm on my way, I say, and I hang up. I take one last longing look at the beer I didn't drink and spill it down the drain. Then I grab Sasha's coat from the front hallway and rummage through the mudroom for her boots. They're not there. They're not on the floor of her bedroom either. I sit down on the edge of her bed and gently shake her out of sleep.
Hey, baby, I whisper. Daddy's got to go to work.
She blinks up at me.
It's the middle of the night.
Technically, it's only 9:30 p.m., but time is relative when you're 7 years old. I know. I'm going to take you over to Mrs. Whitbury's. Mrs. Whitbury probably has a first name, but I haven't ever used it. She lives across the street and is the widow of a guy who'd been on the job for 35 years, so she understands that emergencies happen. She babysat Sasha back when Hannah and I were together, and nowadays when Sasha is staying with me and I get an unexpected call.
Mrs. Whitbury smells like feet.
She does, actually.
Come on, Sash. I need you to get moving.
She sits up, yawning, as I pull on her coat, tie her fleece hat under her chin.
Where are your boots?
I don't know.
Well, they're not downstairs. You'd better find them, because I can't.
She smirks.
Wow, and you're a detective?
Thanks for the vote of confidence. I lift her into my arms. Wear your slippers, I say. I'll carry you to the car. I buckle her into her car seat, even though we're only going 20 yards. And that's when I see them. The boots,
lying on the rubber mats in the back seat. She must have kicked them off on the way home from Hanover, and I didn't notice, since I'd carried her into the house. If only all mysteries were that easy to solve. Mrs. Whitbury opens the door as if she's been expecting us. "I'm so sorry to bother you," I begin, but she waves me off.
"Not at all," she says. "I was just hoping for a little company anyway. Sasha, I can't remember, are you a fan of chocolate ice cream or cookie dough?"
I set Sasha down inside the threshold. "Thanks," I mouth to Mrs. Whitbury, and I turn to leave, already mentally mapping out the fastest route to the crime scene.
"Daddy!"
I turn back to find Sasha with her arms outstretched. For a long time after the divorce, Sasha couldn't stand to have anyone leave her. We came up with a ritual that somehow, along the way, turned into a good luck charm. "Kiss, hug, high five," I say, kneeling down and putting the motions to the words. Then we press our thumbs together. "Bag of peanuts." Sasha leans her forehead against mine. "Don't worry," we say in unison. She waves to me as Mrs. Whitbury closes the door. I stick a magnetic light on the top of my car and drive 20 miles over the speed limit before realizing that the dead guy won't be getting any deader if I'm 5 minutes late, and that there's black ice all over the roads. Which reminds me, I never turned off the hose, and by the time I get home, Sasha's rank might well have spread to the entirety of my back lawn. "Dear Auntie M," I think, "I had to second mortgage my house to pay my water bill. What should I do? Troubled in Townsend. Dear Troubled, drink less." I'm still smiling when I pull up to the spot where police tape is marking a crime scene. Urquhart meets me as I am checking out the abandoned vehicle, a Pontiac. I brush off a bit of snow from the window and peer inside with a flashlight to see a back seat full of empty gin bottles.
"Captain, sorry to call you in," he says.
"What have you got?"
"A jogger found a body in the woods. Guy's half naked and there's blood all over him."
I start to follow him along a marked trail. Who the hell goes jogging at night in the dead of winter? The victim is half-dressed and frozen. His pants are pulled around his ankles. I do a quick canvas of the other officers to see what evidence they've found, which is minimal. Except for all the blood on the man's extremities, there's no hint of an altercation. There are footprints that match the victim's one remaining sneaker and another set that apparently were made by the jogger, whose alibi already eliminated him as a suspect. But the perp either brushed his own footprints away or flew in for the kill. I crouch down and am examining the crosshatch abrasions on the victim's lower left palm when the chief arrives.
"Jesus H," he says. "Suicide or homicide?"
"I'm not sure. If it's homicide, where are the signs of a struggle? Or the defense wounds on the hands? It's almost as if the skin's been rubbed off raw instead of scratched, and there's no trauma to the forearms. If it's suicide, why is the guy in his underwear, and how did he kill himself? The blood is on his knuckles and knees, not his wrists. The truth is, we just don't see this often enough in Townsend, Vermont, to make a quick judgment call."
"I don't know yet," I hedge. "Sexual assault seems like a given, though."
Suddenly, a teenager steps out of the edge of the woods.
"Actually, you're both wrong," he says.
"Who the hell are you?"
the chief asks, and two of the patrolmen take a step forward to flank the boy.
"Not you again," Urquhart says. "He showed up at a robbery about a month ago. He's some kind of crime scene groupie. Get lost, kid, you don't belong here."
"Wait," I say, vaguely remembering the teenager from that robbery scene. "Right now, I'm laying odds that this kid's the perp, and I don't want him to bolt."
It's really very simple,
the boy continues, staring at the body.
On episode 26 of season 2, the whole Crime Busters team got hauled up to Mount Washington to investigate a naked guy who was found at the summit. No one could figure out what a naked guy was doing on top of a mountain, but it turned out to be hypothermia. The same thing happened to this man. He became disoriented and fell down. As his core body temperature rose, he took off his own clothes because he felt hot. But in reality, that's what made him freeze to death.
He grins.
I can't believe you guys didn't know that.
The chief narrows his eyes. What's your name?
Jacob.
Urquhart frowns. People who freeze to death don't usually bleed all over the place. Urquhart! The chief snaps.
He didn't bleed all over the place, Jacob says. Blood spatter would show up in the snow, but instead there's just transfer. Look at the wounds. They're abrasions on the knuckles, the knees, and the lower hands. He fell down and he scraped himself up. The blood on the snow came from him crawling around before he lost consciousness.
I look at Jacob carefully. One major flaw with his theory, of course, is that you don't spontaneously start bleeding when you crawl around on the snow. If that were the case, there would be hundreds of elementary school children exsanguinating at recess during the winters in Vermont. There's something just the tiniest bit, well, off about him. His voice is too flat and high. He won't make eye contact. He's bouncing on the balls of his feet, and I don't even think he realizes it. On the spot where he's been bouncing, the snow is melted, revealing a patch of briars. I kick at the ground beneath my boots and shake my head. That poor drunk dead bastard had the misfortune to fall down in a field of brambles. Before I can say anything else, the regional medical examiner arrives. Wayne Nussbaum went to Clown College before getting his medical degree, although I haven't seen the guy crack a smile in the 15 years I've been on the job. Greetings all, he says, coming into the clearing of artificial light. I hear you have a murder mystery on your hands. You think it could be hypothermia? I ask. He considers this, carefully rolling the victim forward and examining the back of his head. I've never seen it firsthand, but I've read about it. It certainly would fit the bill. Wayne glances up at me. Nice work. But you didn't need to pull me away from the Bruins in overtime for death by natural causes. I glance to the spot where Jacob was standing moments before, but he's disappeared.
Jacob. I run all the way home, even though I hate running. I can't wait to transcribe my notes from the crime scene into a fresh notebook. I plan to draw pictures using colored pencils and scaled maps. I slip into the house through the garage, and I'm just taking off my boots when the door opens behind me again. Immediately, I freeze. It's Theo. What if he asks me what I've been doing? I have never been a very good liar. If he asks, I'm going to have to tell him about the scanner and the dead body and the hypothermia. And that makes me angry because right now I want to keep it all to myself instead of sharing it. I tuck my notebook into the back of my pants and pull my sweater down over it and then cross my hands behind my back to hide it. What, now you're going to spy on me? Theo says, kicking off his boots. Well, why don't you get your own life? It isn't until he's halfway up the stairs that I look at him and see how red his cheeks are, how his hair is windblown. I wonder where he's been, and if Mom knows. And then the thought is gone, replaced by the vision of the dead man's bare skin, blue underneath the floodlights, and the pink, stained snow all around him. I'll have to remember all that the next time I set up a crime scene. I could use food coloring in water and spray it on the snow outside. and then I'll draw with red Sharpie on my knuckles and my knees. Although I'm not too keen on lying in the snow in my underwear, I am willing to make the sacrifice for a scenario that will totally stump my mother. I'm still humming under my breath when I get to my room. I take off my clothes and put on my pajamas. Then I sit down at my desk and carefully cut the page out of the old used notebook so that I don't have to hear the sound of paper being crumpled or torn. I take out a fresh spiral notebook and begin to sketch the crime scene. Go figure. On a scale of 1 to 10, this day has turned out to be an 11. Case 2, Irony 101. Immet St. Guillen was an honor student pursuing a degree in criminal justice in New York. One winter night in 2006, she went out drinking with her friends, eventually splitting from them and heading to Soho, where she called a friend to say she was at a bar. She never returned home. Instead, her naked body was found 14 miles away in a deserted area off the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn, wrapped in a flowered bedspread. Her hair had been cut off on one side. Her hands and feet were secured with plastic ties. She'd been gagged with a sock, and her face was wrapped in packaging tape. She had been raped, sodomized, and suffocated. Blood was found on one of those plastic ties, but DNA evidence revealed that it didn't belong to the victim. Instead, it was matched to Daryl Littlejohn, a bouncer who had been asked to remove the drunk young woman from the bar at around 4 a.m. Witnesses said they argued before leaving the bar. Fibers were also found in Littlejohn's residence that matched those on the packing tape on the victim's body. Littlejohn was also arraigned for a second kidnapping and assault of another college student who managed to get away from him after he impersonated a police officer, handcuffed her, and threw her into his van. And Immet St. Guillen, tragically, went from being a student of criminal justice to being the lesson taught by professors of forensic DNA analysis.
Chapter 2. Emma. I used to have friends. Back before I had children, when I was working at a textbook publishing company outside of Boston, I'd hang out with some of the other editors after hours. We'd go for sushi or to see a movie. When I met Henry, he was a technical consultant on a computer programming textbook. My friends were the ones who encouraged me to ask him on a date, since he seemed too shy to ask me. They leaned over my cubicle, laughing, asking if he had a Superman side underneath all that Clark Kent. And when Henry and I got married, they were bridesmaids. Then I got pregnant, and suddenly the people I could relate to were enrolled in my birthing class, practicing their breathing and talking about the best deals on diaper genies. After we had our babies, three of the other mothers and I formed a casual playgroup. We rotated hosting duties. The adults would sit on the couch and gossip while the babies rolled around on the floor with a collection of toys. Our children got older and started to play with each other instead of beside each other. All of them, that is, except Jacob. My friends' boys zoomed matchbox cars all over the carpet, but Jacob lined them up with military precision, bumper to bumper. While the other kids colored outside the lines, Jacob drew neat little blocks in a perfect rainbow spectrum. I didn't notice at first when my friends forgot to mention at whose house the next playgroup was taking place. I didn't read between the lines when I hosted and two of the mothers begged off because of previous engagements. But that afternoon, Jacob got frustrated when my friend's daughter reached for the truck whose wheels he was spinning, and he hit her so hard that she fell against the edge of the coffee table. "I can't do this anymore," my friend said, gathering up her shrieking child. "I'm sorry, Emma." But it was an accident. Jacob didn't understand what he was doing. She stared at me. Do you? After that, I didn't really have friends anymore. Who had time with all the early intervention specialists that were occupying every minute of Jacob's life? I spent the entire day on the carpet with him, forcing him to interact, and at night I stayed up reading the latest books about autism research, as if I might find a solution that even the experts couldn't. Eventually, I met families at Theo's preschool, who were welcoming at first, but distanced themselves when they met Theo's older brother. When they invited us for dinner and all I could talk about was how a cream of transdermal glutathione had helped some autistic kids who couldn't produce enough of the substance themselves to bind to and remove toxins from the body. Isolation. A fixation on one particular subject. An inability to connect socially. Jacob was the one diagnosed, but I might as well have Asperger's too. When I come downstairs at 7 in the morning, Jacob's already sitting at the kitchen table, showered and dressed. An ordinary teenager would sleep in till noon on a Sunday. Theo will, certainly. But then again, Jacob isn't ordinary. His routine of getting up for school trumps the fact that it's a weekend and there's no urgency to leave the house. Even when it's a snow day and school is canceled, Jacob will get dressed instead of going back to bed. He's poring over the Sunday paper. "Since when do you read the paper?" I ask.
"What kind of mother doesn't want her son to be aware of current events?"
"Yeah. I'm not falling for that one. Let me guess. You're clipping Staples coupons for crazy glue?" Jacob goes through that stuff like water. It's part of the process used to get fingerprints off objects, and it's a common occurrence in this household for something to go missing. My car keys, Theo's toothbrush, and then to resurface beneath the overturned fish tank Jacob uses to fume for prints. I measure out enough coffee into the automatic drip to make me human, and then get started on breakfast for Jacob. It's a challenge. He doesn't eat glutens, and he doesn't eat caseins. Basically, that means no wheat, oat, rye, barley, or dairy. Since there's no cure yet for Asperger's, we treat the symptoms. And for some reason, if I regulate his diet, his behavior improves. When he cheats, like he did at Christmas, I can see him slipping backward, stimming or having meltdowns. Frankly, with 1 in 100 kids in the United States being diagnosed on the spectrum, I bet I could have a top-rated show on the Food Network, Alimentary Autism. Jacob doesn't share my culinary enthusiasm. He says that I'm what you'd get if you crossed Jenny Craig with Josef Mengele. 5 days of the week, in addition to having a limited diet, Jacob eats by color. I don't really remember how this started, but it's a routine. All Monday food is green. All Tuesday food is red. All Wednesday food is yellow, and so on. For some reason, this helped with his sense of structure. Weekends, though, are free-for-alls. So this morning, my breakfast spread includes defrosted homemade tapioca rice muffins and Enviro Kids Koala Crisp cereal with soy milk. I fry up some Applegate Farms turkey bacon and set out Skippy peanut butter and gluten-free bread. I have a 3-inch binder full of food labels and toll-free numbers that is my chef's Bible. I also have grape juice, because Jacob mixes it with his liposome-enclosed glutathione. 1 teaspoon, plus 1/4 teaspoon of vitamin C powder. It still tastes like sulfur, but it's better than the previous alternative. A cream he rubbed on his feet and covered with socks because it smelled so bad. The downside of the glutathione, though, pales in comparison to its upside. Binding and removing toxins that Jacob's body can't do itself.
and leaving him with better mental acuity. The food is only part of the buffet. I take out the tiny silicone bowls we use for Jacob's supplements. Every day, he takes a multivitamin, a taurine capsule, and an omega-3 tablet. The taurine prevents meltdowns. The fatty acids help with mental flexibility. He lifts the newspaper up in front of his face as I set down the two treatments he hates the most, the oxytocin nasal spray and the B12 shot he injects himself, both of which help with anxiety. "You can hide, but you can't run," I say, tugging down the edge of the newspaper. You would think that the shot is the worst for him, but he actually lifts up his shirt and pinches his stomach to inject himself without much fanfare. However, for a kid who's got sensory issues, using a nasal spray is like waterboarding. Every day I watch Jacob stare down that bottle and finally convince himself he will be able to handle the feeling of the liquid dripping down his throat. And every day, it breaks my heart. It goes without saying that none of these supplements, which cost hundreds of dollars each month, are covered by medical insurance. I put a plate of muffins in front of him as he turns another page in the paper. "Did you brush your teeth?" "Yes," Jacob mutters. I put my hand down on the paper so that it blocks his view. "Really?" The few times Jacob lies, it's so obvious to me that all I have to do is raise an eyebrow and he caves. The only times I've ever seen him attempt dishonesty are when he's asked to do something he doesn't want to do, like take his supplements or brush his teeth, or to avoid conflict. In those cases, he'll say what he thinks I want to hear. "I'll do it after I eat," he promises, and I know he will. "Yes!" he crows suddenly. "It's in here." "What?" Jacob leans over, reading aloud. "Police in Townsend recovered the body of 53-year-old Wade Deakins in a wooded area off Route 140. Deakins succumbed to hypothermia. No foul play was indicated." He scoffs, shaking his head. "Can you believe that got buried on page A14? "Yes," I say. "It's gruesome. Why would anybody want to read about a man who froze to death?" I suddenly pause in the act of stirring half and half into my coffee. "How did you know that article was going to be in the paper this morning?" He hesitates, aware he's been caught in the act.
"It was a lucky guess."
I fold my arms and stare at him. Even if he won't look me in the eye, he can feel the heat of my gaze.
"Okay," he confesses. "I heard about it on the scanner last night."
I consider the way he's rocking in his seat and the blush that has continued to work its way up his face.
"And?" "I went there."
"You what?"
"It was last night. I took my bike."
"You rode your bike in the freezing cold to Route 140.
Do you want to hear the story or not?"
Jacob says, and I stop interrupting.
"The police found a body in the woods, and the detective was leaning towards sexual assault and homicide."
"Oh my God. But the evidence didn't support that." He beams.
"I solved their case for them."
My jaw drops. "And they were okay with that?"
"Well, no. But they needed help. They were totally going in the wrong direction given the wounds to the body."
"Jacob, you can't just crush a crime scene. You're a civilian."
"I'm a civilian with a better understanding of forensic science than the local police,"
he argues.
"I even let the detective take the credit."
I have visions of the Townsend police showing up at my house today to berate me, at best, and arrest Jacob, at worst. Isn't it a misdemeanor to tamper with a police investigation? I imagine the fallout if it becomes public knowledge that Auntie M, the advice expert, doesn't even know where her own son is at night. Listen to me, I say. You are absolutely not to do that again, ever. What if it was a homicide, Jacob? What if the killer had come after you? I watch him consider this.
Well, he says, entirely literal. I guess I would have to run really fast.
Consider it a new house rule. You are not to sneak out of here unless you tell me first.
Technically, that wouldn't be sneaking, he points out.
Jacob, so help me? He bobs his head.
Don't sneak out to go to a crime scene. Got it.
Then he looks directly at me, something that happens so infrequently I find myself catching my breath.
But Mom, seriously, I wish you could have seen it. The crosshatch marks on the guy's shins and...
Jacob, that guy died a horrible, lonely death and deserves a little respect. But even as I say it, I know he can't understand. 2 years ago, at my father's funeral, Jacob asked if the casket could be opened before the burial. I thought it was to say goodbye to a relative he'd loved. But instead, Jacob had put his hand against my father's cold, rice paper cheek.
I just want to know what dead feels like, he had said.
I take the newspaper and fold it up. You'll write a note to the detective today apologizing for getting in his way.
I don't know his name.
Google it, I say. Oh, and you can consider yourself grounded until otherwise notified.
Grounded? You mean like I can't leave the house?
Not unless you're going to school. To my surprise, Jacob shrugs.
I guess you'll have to call Jess then.
Damn it. I've forgotten about his social skills tutor. Twice a week, Jacob meets with her to practice social interaction skills. A graduate student at UVM who plans to teach autistic kids, Jess Ogilvie is terrific with Jacob. He adores her, just as much as he dreads what she makes him do. Look cashiers in the eye. Initiate conversation with strangers on the bus. Ask bystanders for directions. Today, they've planned to visit a local pizza parlor so that Jacob can practice small talk. But in order to do that, he'll have to be allowed out of the house.
Muffin?
He asks innocently, handing me the platter. I hate it when he knows he's right. Ask the mom of one autistic kid if vaccines had anything to do with her child's condition, and she will vehemently tell you yes. Ask another, and she'll just as vehemently tell you no. The jury's still out, literally. Even though a handful of parents have sued the government, alleging that vaccinations cause their children's autism, I haven't gotten my class action suit check in the mail, and I'm not banking on it. Here are the facts. 1. In 1988, the Centers for Disease Control recommended a change to infant immunization schedules in America, adding 3 hepatitis B shots, including 1 at birth, and 3 hemophilus B shots, all given before the baby is 6 months old. 2. Drug companies stepped up to the challenge by providing multiple-dose containers of vaccines preserved with thimerosal, an antibacterial made up of 49% ethyl mercury. 3. Although the effects of mercury poisoning had been identified in the 1940s, the Food and Drug Administration and the CDC didn't consider the effects of the dosage that newborns would receive because of these shots. The drug companies didn't raise a red flag either, even though the new regimen meant an average 2-month-old at a well baby checkup got a single day dose of mercury 100 times greater than the government's long-term safe exposure level. 4. The symptomology of autism looks an awful lot like the symptomology of mercury poisoning. To give you an example, when scientists studied the migration of mercury into primate brains, they noticed that the primates began to avoid eye contact. 5. Between 1999 and 2002, thimerosal was quietly removed from the majority of childhood vaccines. There's the opposing argument, too, that ethyl mercury, the kind in the vaccines, leaves the body faster than methyl mercury, the kind that's a poison. That, in spite of the fact that most vaccines are now mercury-free, autism is still on the rise. That the CDC, the World Health Organization, and the Institute of Medicine completed 5 large studies, none of which have found a link between vaccines and autism. Those facts are compelling. But the next one is all I needed to convince me there's some sort of connection. 1. My son looked like any other 2-year-old until he had a round of shots that included DTaP, Hib, and hepatitis B. I don't think it's a casual link. After all, out of 100 children receiving the same vaccine schedule, 99 will never become autistic. But just like we probably all have markers for cancer in our genes, if you smoke 2 packs a day, you're more likely to develop it than if you don't. Kids with a certain predisposition in their genes can't get rid of mercury as easily as most of us can, and, as a result, wind up on the spectrum. I'm not one of those parents who swings so far to the other side that she eschews immunization. When Theo was born, he had his shots. In my opinion, the benefits of vaccination still outweigh the risks. I believe in vaccines. I do. I just believe in spreading them out. It's because of Jess Ogilvie that Jacob went to his junior prom. It wasn't something I ever expected him to do, to be honest. There are a lot of moments I used to consider definites for a child of mine that, after Jacob's diagnosis, became wishes instead. Going to college. Holding down a job. Finding someone to love him. I suppose Theo bears the brunt of all my dreams. I hope for Jacob to blend into the world more seamlessly. But I hope for his brother to leave his mark. Which is why, when Jacob announced last spring that he planned to go to his spring fling, I was surprised. "With whom?" I asked.
"Well," Jacob said, "Jess and I haven't quite worked that out yet."
I could see why Jess had suggested it. The photographs, the dancing, the table conversation. All of these were skills he needed to know. I agreed with her, but I also didn't want to see Jacob hurt. What if no one he asked would go with him? Don't think I'm a bad mother. I'm just a realistic one. I knew that Jacob was handsome, funny, and so smart it sometimes left me reeling. It was hard, though, for others to see him in that light. To them, he just seemed odd. That night, I went into Jacob's room. The pleasure of seeing him excited for once about initiating a social interaction was tempered by the thought of a string of girls laughing in his face. "So," I said, sitting down on the edge of the bed. I waited for him to put down his reading material, the Journal of Forensic Sciences. "The prom, huh?"
"Yes," he said. "Jess thinks it's a good idea."
"How about you? Do you think it's a good idea?" Jacob shrugged.
"I guess, but I'm a little worried."
I seized on this. "About what?"
"My date's dress," Jacob said. "If it's orange, I don't think I could deal with it."
A smile tugged at my mouth. "Trust me, no girl wears orange to a prom." I picked at a thread on his blanket. Is there any particular girl you're thinking of asking?
No.
No?
That way I won't be disappointed,
he said, matter of fact. I hesitated. I think it's terrific that you're trying this, and even if it doesn't work out...
Mom, Jacob interrupted, of course it will work out. There are 402 girls in my school. Assuming that one of them finds me remotely attractive, the probability of getting one of them to say yes is statistically in my favor.
As it was, he had to ask only 83. One finally said yes. Amanda Hillerstein, who had a younger brother with Down syndrome and was kind-hearted enough to see past Jacob's Asperger's, at least for one night. What ensued was a 2-week crash course in prom etiquette. Jess worked with Jacob to make small talk during dinner. Appropriate. Are you visiting colleges this summer? Inappropriate. Did you know there's a place in Tennessee called the Body Farm where you can study how corpses decay? Me? I worked with him on everything else. We practiced how to walk close to a girl instead of keeping a full foot of space between you. We practiced how to look at the camera when someone takes your photograph. We practiced how to ask your date if she'd like to dance. Although Jacob drew the line at slow dancing.
Do I really have to touch her?
The day leading up to the prom, 1,000 pitfalls raced through my head. Jacob had never worn a tuxedo. What if the bow tie aggravated him and he refused to put it on? He hated to bowl because he disliked the thought of putting his feet in shoes that had housed someone else's feet moments before. What if he pitched a fit about his rented patent leather loafers for the same reason? What if the prom decorating committee hadn't gone with an under-the-sea theme like they'd planned, but a disco party instead, with flashing lights and mirrored balls that would overstimulate Jacob's senses? What if Amanda wore her hair loose, and Jacob took one look at her and ran back up to his room? Amanda, bless her heart, had offered to drive since Jacob couldn't. She pulled up in her Jeep Cherokee at 7 o'clock on the dot. Jacob was waiting for her with a wrist corsage he'd picked out at the florist that afternoon. He'd been standing at the window, watching, since 6. Jess had come over with a video camera to record the event for posterity. We all held our breath as Amanda stepped out of her car in a long peach gown.
You said she wouldn't wear orange,
Jacob whispered. It's peach, I corrected.
It's in the orange family,
he said. All he had time for before she knocked. Jacob yanked the door open.
You look beautiful,
he announced, just like we'd practiced. When I took their picture on the front lawn, Jacob even looked at the camera. It remains, to this day, the only photo I have of him where he's doing that. I admit, I cried a little as I watched him extend his crooked elbow to escort his date to her car. Could I have asked for a better outcome? Could Jacob have done a finer job of remembering every lesson we'd worked on so diligently? Jacob opened Amanda's door and then walked around to the passenger side. Oh no, I thought. We totally forgot about that, Jess said. And sure enough, Jess and I watched Jacob slide into his usual position in a car. The back seat.
Theo. This is it, I say. And my mother pulls the car over in front of some random house I've never seen before. When do you want me to come get you? She asks. I don't know. I'm not sure how long it's going to take us to write up the lab report, I say. Well, you have your cell phone. Call me. I nod and get out of the car. Theo, she yells. Aren't you forgetting something? A backpack. If I'm doing schoolwork with an imaginary lab partner, I should at least be smart enough to carry a freaking notebook. Leon's got everything, I say. It's on his computer. She peers over my shoulder to the front door of the house. Are you sure he's expecting you? It doesn't look like anyone's home. Mom, I told you. I talked to Leon 10 minutes before we left the house. I'm supposed to go in the back door. Relax, okay? Make sure you're polite, she says as I shut the car door. Please and thank you, I mutter under my breath. I start up the driveway and along a path that leads around the house. I've just turned the corner when I hear my mother pull away. Of course it looks like there's no one here. I planned it that way. I don't have a lab report to do. I don't even know anyone named Leon. This is a new neighborhood for me. A lot of professors who work at UVM live here. The houses are old and have little brass plaques on them with the years they were built. The really cool thing about old houses is that they have crappy locks. You can jimmy them open most of the time with a credit card slipped in the right way. I don't have a credit card, but my school ID works just as well. I know that no one's home because there aren't any footprints on the driveway after last night's snow, something my mother didn't notice. On the porch, I kick the snow off my sneakers and walk inside. The house smells like old people, oatmeal and mothballs. There's a cane propped inside the entryway, too, but weird, there's also a Gap hoodie hanging up. Maybe their granddaughter left it behind. Like last time, I go to the kitchen first. The first thing I see is a bottle of red wine on the counter. It's about half full. I pop the cork and take a swig, and nearly spit the shit out all over the countertop. How come people drink if it tastes like this? Wiping my mouth, I rummage through the pantry for something to make me forget the taste of the wine, and find a box of crackers. I rip it open and eat a few. Then I check out the contents of the fridge and make myself a Black Forest ham and sage cheddar sandwich on a baguette. No ham and cheese for this house. It's even too fancy for good old yellow mustard. I have to use champagne mustard instead, whatever that is. For a second, I worry it will taste like the wine, but if there's alcohol in it, you could have fooled me. Trailing crumbs, I walk into the living room. I haven't taken my sneakers off, so I'm leaving behind a trail of melting snow, too. I pretend I'm superhuman. I can see through walls. I can hear a pin drop. Nobody could ever take me by surprise. The living room is exactly what you'd be expecting. Couches with crackly leather and stacks of paper everywhere. So many dusty books that even though I don't have asthma, I feel it coming on. A woman and a man live here. I can tell because there are books on gardening and little glass bottles lined up on the mantle. I wonder if they sit in this room and talk about their kids way back when. I bet they finish each other's sentences. Remember when Lewis found a piece of felt on the driveway after Christmas? And he took it to show and tell as proof of Santa Claus? I sit down on the couch. The television remote is on the coffee table, so I pick it up. I put my sandwich down beside me on the couch and turn on the entertainment system, which is much nicer than you'd think for old grandpa and grandma. They have shelves of CDs with every kind of music you can imagine and a state-of-the-art flat-screen HD TV. They have TiVo, too. I punch buttons until I reach the screen to show what they've recorded. Antiques Roadshow. The Three Tenors on Vermont Public TV. And, like, everything on the History Channel. They've also taped a hockey game on NESN, and a movie that aired last weekend, Mission Impossible 3. I double-click that one, because it's hard to believe Mr. and Mrs. Professor watching Tom Cruise kick ass. But sure enough, there it is. So I decide to let them have that one. The rest, I delete. Then I start adding programs to tape. The Girls Next Door. My Super Sweet 16. South Park. and for good measure, I go to HBO and add a dollop of Borat. When that movie came out, it was playing at the same theater as Pirates of the Caribbean 3. I wanted to see Borat, but my mother said I had to wait a decade or so. She bought us tickets to Pirates and said she would meet us in the parking lot after the film, because she had to go grocery shopping. I knew that Jacob would never have suggested it, so I told him that I wanted to let him in on a secret, but he had to promise not to tell Mom. He was so psyched about the secret, he didn't even care that we were breaking the rules. And when I sneaked into the other theater after the opening credits, he came along. And in a way, I guess, he did keep his promise. He never actually told my mother that we'd gone to see Borat. She figured it out when he started quoting lines from the film, like he always does.
"Very nice, very nice. How much? I like to make sexy time."
I think I was grounded for 3 months. I have a fleeting vision of Mrs. Professor turning on her TiVo'd programs and seeing the Playboy bunnies and having a heart attack. Of her husband having a stroke when he finds her. Immediately, I feel like shit. I erase all the programming and put back in the original shows. This is it. This is the last time I'm breaking in somewhere, I tell myself. Even though there's another part of me that knows this won't be true. I'm an addict, but instead of the rush some people get from shooting up or snorting, I need a fix that feels like home. I pick up the telephone, intending to call my mother and ask her to come pick me up. But then on second thought, I put down the receiver. I don't want there to be any trace of me. I want it to feel like I was never here. So I leave the house cleaner than it was when I first entered, and then I start walking home. It's 8 miles, but I can try to hitch once I reach the state highway. After all, Leon's got the kind of parents who wouldn't mind dropping me off.
Oliver. I'm feeling pretty good, because this Friday, I won my case against the pig. Okay, so technically, the pig was not the one who filed the lawsuit. That honor belongs to Buff, short for Buffalo, and I swear I am not making this up, Wings, a 300-pound motorcyclist who was riding his vintage Harley down a road in Shelburne when a gigantic rogue pig wandered off the side of the road and directly into his path. As a result of the accident, Mr. Wings lost an eye, something he showed the jury at one point by lifting up his black satin patch, which, of course, I objected to. Anyway, when Wings got out of the hospital, he sued the owner of the land from which the pig wandered. But it turned out to be more complicated than that. Elmer Hodgkiss, the owner of the pig, was only renting the property from a landlord who lived down in Brattleboro, an 80-year-old lady named Selma Frack. In Elmer's lease was a direct clause that said no pets, no animals. But Elmer defended his forbidden pig keeping, and his equally subversive chicken keeping for that matter, on the grounds that Selma was in a nursing home and never visited the property, and what she didn't know wouldn't hurt her. I was representing Selma Frack. Her caretaker at the Green Willow Assisted Living Facility told me that Selma picked me out of the phone book because of my Yellow Pages ad. Oliver O. Bond, Esquire, it read, with a graphic that looked like 007's gun, except it was 00B, my initials. When you need an attorney who won't be shaken or stirred. Thanks, I said. I came up with that myself. The caretaker just stared at me blankly. She liked the fact that she could read the font. Most of them lawyers, their print is too tiny. In spite of the fact that Buff Wings wanted Selma's insurance to cover his medical bills, I had 2 strikes in my favor. One, Buff Wings' convoluted argument was that Selma should be held responsible even though she, A, didn't know about the pig, B, had expressly banned the pig, and C, had evicted Elmer Hodgkiss as soon as she learned that he had loosed his killer pig on the general populace. 2, Buff Wings had chosen to represent himself. I had trotted out experts to refute Wings's claims about damages, both emotional and physical. For example, Did you know that there is a guy from Ohio who actually is an expert on driving with one eye? And that in almost all states, you can continue to drive, even a motorcycle, as long as your other eye has 20/20 vision? And that in certain circumstances, the term blind spot can be politically incorrect? After the judge had ruled in our favor, I followed Selma and her caretaker to the elevator at the courthouse. "Well," the caretaker said, "all's well that ends well." I glanced down at Selma, who'd been asleep for most of the proceedings. "It's all fun and games till somebody loses an eye," I replied. "Please extend my congratulations to Mrs. Frack on her victory in court." Then I ran down the stairs to the parking lot, punching my fist in the air. I have 100% success rate in my litigation. So what if I've only had one case? Contrary to popular belief, the ink is not still drying on my bar certificate. That's pizza sauce. But it was an honest accident. I mean, since my office is above the town pizza joint, and Mama Spatacopoulos routinely blocks my ascension on the staircase to thrust a plate of spaghetti or a mushroom and onion pie into my hands, it would be downright rude to turn her down. Coupled with that is the fact that I can't really afford to eat, and turning away free food would be stupid. Granted, it was dumb of me to grab a makeshift napkin from a stack of papers on my desk, but the odds of it being my bar certificate, as opposed to my recent Chinese takeout order, had been pretty slim. If any new clients ask to see my bar certificate, I'm just going to tell them it's being framed. Sure enough, as I am headed back inside, Mama S. meets me with a calzone. "You gotta wear a hat, Oliver." My hair is still dripping wet from my shower at the high school locker room. Ice has started to form. "You'll take care of me when I have pneumonia, won't you?" I tease. She laughs and pushes the box at me. As I jog up the stairs, Thor starts barking his head off. I open the door just a crack so that he doesn't come flying out. "Relax," I say. "I was only gone for 15 minutes. He launches all 12 pounds of himself at me. Thor's a miniature poodle. He doesn't like to be called a poodle within hearing distance. He'll growl, and can you blame him? What guy dog wants to be a poodle? They should only come in female denominations, if you ask me. I do the best I can for him. I gave him the name of a mighty warrior. I let his hair grow out, but instead of making him look less effeminate, it only makes him look more like a mop head. I pick him up and tuck him into my arm like a football, and then I notice that there are feathers all over my office. "Oh, crap," I say. "What did you do, Thor?" Setting him down, I survey the damage. "Great. Thank you, mighty guard dog, for protecting me from my own damn pillow." I drag the vacuum out of the closet and start to suck up the debris. It's my own fault, I know, for not putting away my bedding before running my errand. My office is currently also doubling as my living quarters. Not permanently, of course, but do you know how expensive it is to pay rent on a law office and an apartment? Plus, being in town, I can walk to the high school every day, and the janitor there has been very cool about letting me use the locker room as my own personal shower. I gave him some free advice about his divorce, and this is his thanks. Usually I fold up my blanket and tuck it with my pillow in the closet. I hide my little 13-inch TV inside a cavernously empty filing cabinet. That way, if a client comes in to retain my services, they won't get the vibe that I'm hideously unsuccessful. I'm just new in town, that's all. Which is why I spend more time organizing the paper clips on my desk than actually doing any legal work. I graduated with honors from the University of Vermont 7 years ago with a degree in English. Here's a little nugget of wisdom for you, just in case you're interested. You can't practice English in the real world. What skills did I have, honestly? I could outread anyone in a quick draw. I could write a totally smoking analytical essay about the homoerotic overtones of Shakespeare's sonnets. Yeah, that and $1.50 will get you a cup of coffee. So I decided that I needed to stop living in the theoretical and start experiencing the physical. I answered a classified ad I'd found in the Burlington Free Press to be a farrier's apprentice. I traveled around the countryside and learned to spot what was normal gait for a horse and what wasn't. I studied how to trim a donkey's hoof and how to shape a horseshoe around an anvil, nail it into place, file it down, and watch the animal take off again. I like being a farrier. I like the feel of 1,500 pounds of horse pressed up against my shoulder as I bent a leg to examine the hoof. But after 4 years, I got restless. I decided to go to law school, for the same reason everyone else goes to law school, because I had no idea what else to do. I'll be a good lawyer, maybe even a great one. But here I am at 28, and my secret fear is that I'm going to be just another guy who spends his whole life making money by doing something he's never really loved to do. I have just put the vacuum back in the closet when there is a tentative knock at the door. A man stands there in Carhartt coveralls, feeding the seam of a black wool cap through his hands. He reeks of smoke. "Can I help you?" I ask.
"I'm looking for the lawyer."
"That's me." On the couch, Thor begins to growl. I shoot him a dirty glance. If he starts scaring away my potential clients, he'll be homeless.
"Really?" the man says, peering at me. "You don't look old enough to be a lawyer."
"I'm 28, I say. "Want to see my driver's license?"
"No, no," the man says. I got a problem."
I usher him into the office, closing the door behind him. "Why don't you have a seat, Mr.
Esch," he says, settling down. "Homer Esch. I was out in my backyard this morning burning brush, and the fire got out of control."
He looks up at me as I sit down at my desk.
"It kind of burned down my neighbor's house."
"Kind of, or did?"
"Did," he juts out his jaw. "I had a burn permit, though."
"Great." I write that down on a legal pad. "Licensed to burn." "Were there any casualties?"
"No.